Federal Drive is presented by GEHA, Government Employees Health Association, proudly providing health and dental benefits to federal employees and their families. Visit GEHA.com.
Back in November of last year, the National Institutes of Health welcomed its 17th director, Monica Bertagnoli. Operating the government's health research wing in a post-pandemic environment comes with a set of different challenges than what her predecessors dealt with. I recently got the chance to speak with her about that and what she's learned so far just 6 months on the job. You've been on the job now for just over 7 months or so, or coming up on the 7 month anniversary. Any observations so far and or lessons learned right off the bat just in these first few months?
Well, I think there's two things that I can say. First of all, what has been wonderful is just the camaraderie and willingness across all the different 27 institutes and centers of the NIH, who all have their own amazing leaders, of me in this position, seeing such camaraderie and willingness to work together and track record of working together across all those different leaders. That's, I think, truly exceptional and illustrates a great commitment toward really doing whatever it takes to improve health for people. I had heard before I arrived in this position that, you know, watch out for silos, watch out for, and I'm really pleased to say that while we still have silos and we have a tremendous willingness from everyone to eliminate those and work together as never before, which has been really wonderful. The other thing I will say that is a surprise to me, but a really wonderful one, is the willingness of the other heads of agencies across HHS to also work together. The understanding that, you know, NIH represents the main research arm of the effort, but we have so much to gain from working with partners across all of HHS, and we're now getting ready to do some, I think, really transformative work together, and that's also been great.
Yeah, coming from the National Cancer Institute, were there any assumptions that you had about the role that maybe turned out to not be true, or, you know, vice versa? Was there something that you didn't quite see? You know, you were from a pretty high view before, but now you're even higher view about the agency itself.
I think that's the main one I've already described, you know, at NCI, and I was only there for a year. I was just barely getting my feet wet. You know, at NCI, I was intensely focused on that institute itself and all of its workings and really trying to optimize all the functions of NCI, and really hadn't yet lifted my head to think what was possible across the broader scope of NIH. So I think that's the major difference. The director really needs to think about every corner of NIH and the relationship of NIH to all of the other external parties. So it is a completely different job, frankly.
Yeah, let's get into the role of NIH. You had mentioned that you're the research effort of the HHS mission, but do you see an evolving role of the National Institute of Health, especially in, let's say, at a post-COVID world?
We always have an evolving role. Okay, we have two aspects to what we do. First, we understand that at NIH, our work has to encompass the research laboratory, it has to encompass the clinic, and it cannot stop at the door to the doctor's office. It also has to fully encompass all of the communities that we serve. And those communities include, you know, rural sites in America, they include busy metropolitan areas, and they also include the rest of the world, where lessons in health are critical. And so we constantly have to maintain an infrastructure that can serve that really, really broad environment. And then also, as COVID illustrated, be able, when needed, to be in reactive mode, because we can't always anticipate what new threats are going to arise. And I'll say that evolving, all of biomedical research evolves constantly, but our focus is on maintaining that infrastructure so that we make progress all the time, so that we also are ready to jump in whenever we need to react to a new threat.
Can we get a little specific there? What changes have you seen across the agency and maybe, and, you know, just the national health strategy overall coming out of, you know, still being able to smell the fires of the COVID pandemic?
Well, I'll just raise a couple because there are so many. But let me give you the ones that I think are the highlights. Number one, the fragility of so many communities within the United States in particular, the disproportional impact on some communities that are experiencing health disparities of that virus. That one just reminds us every single day that we have to overcome those disparities. So it highlighted that as never before. Again, something that we had been targeting, but it just made it so much more real to everyone to see how hard hit those communities were. Number two, the trust issue that was uncovered by the COVID-19 pandemic. Someone will say that, you know, the current environment created this trust issue. You know, I think the trust issue must have been there even before, and perhaps the COVID pandemic really highlighted it. I think this has taught us in the biomedical research community that we can't just put out our knowledge, put out what we've learned, and expect everyone just to take it in and act upon it. We have to earn the trust of communities that lack it. And this again drives us to be better listeners and better partners to communities of need out there who really are experiencing disproportionate effects to health challenges. And I think has redoubled our dedication to listening to people and delivering what they need, not just assuming that our research is going to speak for itself. And that is taking us in a new direction that I think is very powerful.
You know, as the research wing of the government's health program, it almost seemed as if during the pandemic, just the process of health research just came under intense scrutiny. You know, everybody was learning kind of on the go. Has NIH taken any steps towards maybe improving that trust or in the actual process itself and saying, hey, you know, we're researching here. We're not necessarily going to have all the right answers right away. Was that sort of the seed of some of the issues that you saw?
No, I'd take that in a little bit different direction and say that research means that people out there, all the people in the communities we serve, have to be part of the answers, right? You know, we can't produce answers that say, here's what you need to do to stay healthy, unless we have people out there who are our partners in being able to deliver those answers. That's number one. And then number two, and this is the one that I think I have taken most to heart, is that the people who were in communities of disparity, the people who have had the least trust in the results of research, were the ones who were left out of research. So if we're going to get those answers, we have to convince people that everyone needs to be part of helping us find those answers.
Yeah, and on the note of inclusivity, you are the second woman to ever run the NIH. You know, what can you speak about the rise in female leadership that you're seeing, particularly in the medical field?
Yeah, I think it's really exciting. And I think it is the result of decades of sustained progress in eliminating unconscious bias and ensuring that the best minds and those with the best passion are able to assume leadership jobs, and that there shouldn't be kind of these inappropriate, let's say, roadblocks to people getting there. And I think we're seeing that for women. We're seeing that for many other aspects of our communities. You hear us talk a lot about also promoting inclusion of various other perspectives in biomedical research and in leadership. And I think the need, again, to get deeply into the communities we serve are another aspect of that. Not only am I a woman, I'm somebody who grew up in a very remote rural community. And that's just another segment of our society, example of someone whose voice I think we need if we're going to conquer problems for everybody.
Gotcha. And can you speak to any particular advancements so far that you are proud of, you know, or, you know, I know you've only been at it for 7 months, so the list of accomplishments may not be as long as one might hope, or anything that you are working towards that you are really trying to take an interest in and have a driver's seat role in?
So one of them is it comes from being a doctor in a clinic, also being a researcher, kind of a spectrum of research, but also being a doctor in a clinic and sitting there thinking, you know, I know what kind of data and data quality I need if I'm going to publish a new manuscript. And I also sat in clinic and realized, look at the data quality that I'm using to make life-altering decisions with my patients day in and day out. And let me tell you, the data quality doctors and patients are using in the clinic is not where we would like it to be, because these decisions have incredible implications for people, you know, far more than, frankly, than me publishing a paper. So I have been committed for a long time in really improving our ability to deliver data that is of very high quality and can really be much better at letting our doctors and patients make critical decisions in clinic every day. And so those are some of the things that we've launched already. And these data have to come from all aspects of biomedical research, from the laboratory all the way to the communities. So we have a number of initiatives that we've already launched, making sure that we gather more data from the clinical care environment. We work not only in NIH, but across all of HHS to do so, and that also we integrate this with what's coming out of our laboratories in a way that lets us return real results to our patients and our care providers.
Did you happen to speak with any of your, well, I'm sure you have, but your predecessors, did they have any advice for you? We spoke to Dr. Francis Collins a lot on this very program about some of these issues as well. What were some of the tips and tricks that they had left behind for you?
Oh, I was so fortunate that my predecessors have been incredibly generous. Dr. Elias Zerhouni, Dr. Harold Varmus, and certainly Francis Collins have been not only given me incredible support as I entered the position, but still are constant advisors to me. Each of them brings a different and very powerful lens to this job. And so they have been incredibly helpful, supportive, and they are constant advisors still.
It really is kind of a grab bag as far as NIH directors go, as far as where their area of expertise is and, you know, the position they held before, usually running one of the institutes themselves. Does that speak to the NIH's kind of collaboration that you had spoken about earlier and the diversity of fields really coming together and why it makes the agency so unique?
Oh, absolutely. You know, no individual can come into this job with everything that you need to be able to address the depth and breadth of what NIH needs to tackle, you know, and I think each of us were chosen for a particular qualities at the time that might be some of the most emergent issues, but each of us also needs what the others have already brought in. So I agree. I think I have the benefit of being the NIH director who has actually a total of many NIH directors being able to help with the job.
This may be the hardest question to ask you because it's self-analysis. Why do you think you were chosen?
I think it was because we find a time when it is very helpful to have somebody with a strong scientific background, but who's also been a doctor in the clinic, seeing patients every day up until the time I came on as NCI director and bringing the perspective of the doctor in the clinic.
Finishing up, I have to pick your doctor brain. How good are blueberries for my digestive system? Because I had a lot of them this morning and I want to feel good about myself.
I have no idea.
No.
I will say that in my previous experience in looking for better ways to improve diet, that blueberries do have some wonderful antioxidants, which if we take them out of blueberries and concentrate them and use them in our model systems, they're very helpful for preventing cancer and inflammation. What that means when you actually eat blueberries, I'm afraid I don't know.
Leadership today, especially within the federal workforce, is being tested more than ever before. As the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency's Chief People Officer, Elizabeth Comstetter sees a focus on people as absolutely crucial to her leadership style. Comstetter joined Shane Canfield, WEPA CEO, to reflect on her years of experience leading in the federal human capital space.
Hello, and welcome to the Lessons in Leadership podcast. I'm your host, Shane Canfield, CEO of WEPA. Today I'm joined by Dr. Elizabeth Comstetter, Chief People Officer at the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency. Elizabeth, welcome.
Thank you, great to be here.
In your current position at CISA, one of your responsibilities is ensuring a people-first culture. Explain what that is, and what's the role of leadership in creating and shaping that culture?
Yes, at CISA, really paramount to our culture is a people-first driven aspect, so that we are really looking at how do we accomplish our mission through our people. And in order to do that, we really value our people. We want them to feel empowered and supported and respected, and also that their managers care about them. So well-being is important. Psychological safety in the workplace is important, so that all voices and ideas are heard. So I like to call it our North Star. Having a people-first culture really starts with the people in order to get our incredibly difficult mission accomplished. In terms of leadership, which is a great question, I think we all know that culture is really driven by leadership and the behaviors that we allow and we reinforce in our leaders. So we really work at making sure that our leaders are bringing out the best in their people every day. So again, that they feel they can bring their voice, especially an opinion that might not go along with the majority of a group, so that we get that diverse perspective. We get those different ideas and experiences. And that's really where we find that it's important that leaders are purposefully bringing out their talent on their teams to enable our mission.
Yeah, excellent. We're going through a culture project at our work.
Oh, great.
Yeah, it's been 6 months in the making, and it's going really well, but it is work.
Yes.
And it requires from the top down. So I'm also involved in that. I hear you.
Great.
Throughout your career, you've piloted many different talent management programs, including at NASA, the CIA, the FBI, just to name a few, and you have an amazing career. What have you learned, or how have you might have changed along the way in creating and leading those programs?
Yes, and I am so honored to have had a career in public service across multiple federal agencies, always in the realm of human resources and workforce performance. And I think because I study organizations and people in them, I've come to realize, particularly in the federal government, that many of our programs are really grounded in the industrial era thinking, that this is organizationally structured in a hierarchy with boxes and lines on charts, with the center being around jobs and what do we need to get this job done in terms of skills and training. And what I found is that we're really not in the industrial era anymore, where we would promote the smartest people who knew that work, and they would then tell the people on their team how to do things and oversee that work. We're now in a digital era and the information era, where work gets done collaboratively across geographic boundaries and certainly across org charts. So we like to call it networks or hierarchies, and we really need to, again, unleash people so they can find those other people who are working on similar problems or have the right ideas. And so I really like to think of our work now in the talent programs being human-centered. It's more about the user and the experience than about the rules and regulations. So although we have to have rules and regulations, certainly in human resources, is that person experiencing what they need and getting what they need for their role at that time? So not so much on the job, but on the person. So for example, we're recruiting. What's the applicant experiencing? Because if they're not having a good experience with our organization from the time we're recruiting them, they're going to go work for somebody else. Same thing with like first-time supervisors. We know they need certain training, but telling them to sit in a class for 1 week and then hope a year from now they'll remember what they learned to apply, that's not really human-centered. The human-centered is what do they need when they need it, and building modules or just-in-time training and bringing that to the people, to that user, as they need it. So that's really, I think, the most important focus of talent programs today in this era to enable the workers to be the best they can be in their roles.
Excellent. New thinking. This is always an interesting question. Has there been a time when, as a leader, that you've made a mistake? And what is that? And I think most important, what did you take away from that? What did you learn from that?
Well, I kind of chuckle because I think as leaders, we have to learn to recognize our mistakes, admit our mistakes, and that they are opportunities to learn. And so I've had to do my own self-reflection on making mistakes and when things don't turn out the way that I expected them to. Makes me think of a time when I was at the Transportation Security Administration and I was a supervisor. And I was really embroiled with my program. I was the technical leader of it. I understood it. I'd run it for years. And I was making a briefing for a decision that had to be made about this program that was very near and dear to me. And I presented the briefing to one of the very senior people in the agency. And I think there are about 20 people in the room. And I had gone through the briefing, answered all the questions. And that leader then said, okay, I'm going to go around the room and get everybody's opinion, and then everybody gets to vote, which kind of set me aback because there were people in that room that didn't have any technical knowledge about my program. She even turned to the executive assistant there, taking notes on the meeting, and said, go ahead, and I want to hear from you. And I realized, in hindsight, I had stopped listening. I had been in transmitting all of my knowledge and what I saw to be the right way, and I was not listening to different perspectives in the room because I didn't think that, I didn't value that they were bringing any kind of input to this particular decision. And it didn't go as I had hoped. And I left very disappointed and was busy blaming the senior leader and how that meeting was conducted, that she let all these people have opinions when they didn't know, in my mind, didn't know what they were talking about. And so in reflection on that, I realize, and now as I've moved into more senior leadership positions, I realize that was a mistake, that it actually is really important to listen, especially to people who have different perspectives or at a different point in the career, not just the people who know the program or the technical really well. And so that was a mistake I made, and I realized in my own sense I wasn't listening to very different opinions, and I probably should have because I would have learned more about what was needed for this program going forward than just leaving, getting upset that it didn't go a certain way. So I've really practiced active listening. I've practiced making sure there's very different people on teams and certainly on committees or councils, that we need early careers, people new to the agency, people who haven't walked in the shoes of the technical workforce, because they're asking questions we need to hear for these programs to be successful.
Excellent. Your career in talent management means your work is very closely tied to people. And even your title, Chief People Officer, what does that mean to you to be a leader in the federal system with that focus?
Isn't that a great title? I just love the title Chief People Officer, and I think it's my dream job, really, to be focused on people and culture and the workforce strategy for the whole agency. And I'm just so excited to be at CISA at this point in time. We're only 4 years young as an agency, so we're really still creating who we're going to become as an agency and what is our culture and what kind of people and talent do we need to be sure we have to be successful. So it's very exciting for me to be in this role with a intentional focus on culture. Because it's one of those things, if you leave it to chance and you kind of hope it goes the way you want it to, it probably won't. So by building programs, including leadership development programs, including any kind of training and learning and career growth and engagement programs and listening programs, that's what's really key for, I think, for our agency and particularly me in this role. I think in the federal government, we got used to doing annual survey, the Federal Employee Viewpoint Survey that OPM, Office of Personnel Management, runs every year. So we would do a survey and we'd read it and we'd say, oh, this is the opinion of our people. And then we would do action plans and then we'd roll out certain activities that we would hope would increase engagement. In this era, you can't do once a year and understand what your employees' experiences are, what they need, what's working well, and what needs to improve. We need active, ongoing listening programs. So one of the things we're doing at CISA is having more pulse surveys, having more focus groups and what we call sensing sessions, expecting our leaders to have office hours where anybody can come and just talk about what's going well, what do they need, how are things going? Because we feel like it is an ongoing need to hear from our people. And I think in this role, and over the years of serving, I've also realized there's never a one-size-fits-all. You know, we think certain people need certain things at certain times in their career. There's no one-size-fits-all. Neither can we also customize everything to every individual. So there's got to be a sweet spot in building really great talent programs, but also, like I said, thinking about, can we do this in modules? Can we make it a menu? Can we do it just in time as people need it so they can practice the new skill or knowledge in their role? So I think we have such great opportunity, again, with the technology that enables us to really focus on how we connect people with their work and their team to get things done in very new ways.
This is always an interesting question. Is there a figure, either from your personal life, your past, somewhere in history generally, that inspired you, your leadership style, how you view leadership?
There are many figures who have been very inspirational to me, but there is one that sticks out, and that's my mother, Paula Brownlee, who has been a very inspiring leader to me all my life. And I think because, first and foremost, she had a strong family and a strong career, and that's something I always wanted. And I saw her first as my mother, but then I also saw her as a leader in her career and in academia, which was her chosen field. But I always knew her family came first. And as I saw how she balanced different family needs with also a growing and more prominent career positions in leadership, that she had to balance that. And I think I learned from her that you can have both. You have to focus on different things through your career and through your life, but that you don't have to trade one for the other. I've been married, happily married, for 32 years, and I'm a mother of twins who are almost 24 years old. So, and I've had a great career in public service. So I think that having her as a role model has really helped me find my own courage, find my own confidence, and find my own voice in how I can prioritize the things that are most important to me so that I can actually balance both family and career.
And you're doing it well. You're, thank you. Having known you now for 7 or 8 years, yeah. And worked alongside you, your passion is infectious.
Thank you.
Your intelligence and the thoughtfulness with which you approach all of these issues, it's an honor for you to be here, and thank you for your time.
Thank you very much.
I'm Shane Canfield, CEO at WEPA, and until next time, have a great day.
Find the full podcast and future episodes of Lessons in Leadership on the Federal News Network app and anywhere you enjoy your podcasts.